Well, it's nice to see all of you again. I was asked to talk about cosmological radiative transfer. So it's going to be quite a switch of gears from the previous talk, and maybe it doesn't quite belong to this session. And I apologize to those who will feel it's a little bit too technical. Right? So I'm actually going to talk about how we treat radiative transfer in cosmological simulation. Right? It may have nothing to do with real world. Right. So I will talk a little bit about ionization inside the computer and discuss main two stumbling blocks that we have in modeling ionization, star formation and radiative transfer. Then I will talk about something which is abbreviated OTWET, and I will talk about radiative transfer and adaptive mesh refinement simulations, and then I will end up with a call for help. So if you want to model ionization inside the computer, we need to put different ingredients, and some of them are what I call easy physics. This we can actually do today on modern supercomputers fast and sufficiently accurate. And this is dynamics of dark matter, n-body simulations, gas dynamics, and ionization, recombination balance, and heating, atomic physics. So we know how to do that. Those are solved problems. The physics which is hard is actually star formation, about which we know rather little, and radiative transfer, which can be done from the first principles, but it's very difficult to do it numerically. So those are different difficult ingredients, and the first one is difficult because we know very little about this. It's a very complicated process physically, and the second one is just we don't have the good ways of doing it today. And then, of course, there is physics which we don't include, because we don't know how to do that well. And we only hope that maybe it's not needed. And it's possible that 20 years from now, someone will discover that magnetic fields are the most important component of the IGM. And so then we will proudly say that everything we did today is completely wrong. So the star formation, since we know so little about it, how it actually happens in reality, all we can do is to supply very simple phenomenological models like the Schmidt law, and try to hide our ignorance in some parameters which are often assumed to be constant, whereas in reality they're probably time-dependent and scale-dependent. And the only justification we have is that something like that seems to be happening in large and small galaxies. Also, that may be an over-interpretation of the observations. The data transfer, things are complicated from a different point of view. This is radiative transfer equation, result cosmological terms. And it's really Boltzmann equation, because it's a Boltzmann equation, six-dimensional. And everything which is six-dimensional is difficult to do numerically. Right? And in addition, we have this unfortunate fact that photons move very fast. If the photon moved much slower, the life would be much easier for us, but the world would look very different. And so in particular, the speed of light over the sound speed in the ionized IGM is about 30,000, which means that if you're trying to resolve the propagation of photons, you have to have 30,000 radiative transfer steps per each gas dynamics step. There is one button here. That's another Boltzmann equation. This is a Vlasov equation which describes the dynamics of n-body particles, collisionless n-body dark matter. And so we use n-body methods to solve this equation. And for all practical purpose, this problem is solved. So this is an example of a six-dimensional problem, which we know how to solve today on modern supercomputers, actually arbitrary precision. So the fact that the Boltzmann equation, the radiative transfer equation is six-dimensional, doesn't mean that it cannot be solved today. We have a counterexample. We have a six-dimensional equation which can be solved. So all we need is to find a smart way of actually solving this equation. It can be done. So if you think in general what you need to do to treat radiative transfer in the universe, with a few exceptions, you're always going to have a region of the universe which is much less than the whole universe. So if this is the whole universe, your simulation volume is going to be always less, almost always. Right? There are actually ways to get a volume as a whole universe. But if you really want to go into detail, this volume will be much less, and then we have sources distributed everywhere in the universe. we can split them into two sort of population of sources. There are those which are inside your simulation volume, those are called near, and those which are actually outside. And those will create the background which will fall on everything happening inside your region. And those will create a local radiative transfer effects inside. So we have to treat both far and near sources. So the first methods which people ever tried to use was ray tracing, and this is one which is used in stellar radiative transfer. And it's very simple. Ideologically, right, you have a source, and you just imagine that photons go along straight lines and just trace a bunch of photons, either you do it in a random way, a Monte Carlo type model, or you do it in a more regular sort of mesh type way, and you're trying to sample the directions. The problem with this approach is that if you're actually imagining doing this together with the dynamics of dark matter and gas, right, and you have some sort of mesh in which you're doing your gas dynamics, then obviously you want to make sure that the resolution of the radiative transfer is comparable to the resolution of your gas dynamics. Otherwise, you're doing two different things and not consistent with each other. So it really means that you need to have a number of rays which are sufficient to sample each cell on the outer edge of the box, in this case. So the scaling with the number of cells is not favored. And for the far sources, it actually scales as 5/3 of the number of your resolution elements. And for the near sources, it scales with the number of cells times the number of sources. And then if you have any meaningful box which contains hundreds and thousands of sources, then of course those scalings are very disfavorable compared to scalings of hydrodynamics in anybody. Those are way too steep, and that will make this computation very, very slow compared to other parts of your simulation, like gas dynamics, star formation, dark matter dynamics, etc. So those really things which we need to beat down, those things which will prevent ray tracing to be a really way of doing very large simulation self-consistently today. So what we can do is to make sort of a very simple and dirty fix to this using moments of Boltzmann equation. And for those who are not familiar with this, I remind you, if you take a field of massive particles that can gas, that can be dark matter particles, just a bunch of particles, which I describe by a Boltzmann equation, the different moments are density, momentum, pressure tensor, etc. And for the photons, the same thing is the energy density of photons, its flux, radiation, pressure tensor, and then we can continue this moment hierarchy to higher and higher moments. And hierarchy needs to be closed. And again, photons move with speed of light. So for gas dynamics, this hierarchy is closed automatically because the pressure is isotropic. And by supplying the equation of state, we are closing the hierarchy at the second, the third equation. So what you would like to do is to use a trick to close this hierarchy at the same level. So treat it like a gas dynamics. It's another equation, and it's probably one too many. But if you think about the pressure tensor is the average of the intensity in two different directions. And because the photons move with speed of light, then the pressure of photons is always 1/3 the energy density. And it's a relativistic equation of state, which means that we can write the pressure tensor as this little tensor H, it's called Eddington tensor in radiative transfer, times the energy density. And the little H is dimensionless. It's nice because it's always nice to have dimensionless quantities. And it has this property that it's trace equal 1. So it's only 5 independent components rather than 6. So a simple trick is called this Advert approximation. That's one that I've been using for a while. And actually, I did belong to Tom Addo. We use this Eddington tensor. And we really need to close the hierarchy by assuming something. So we calculate this Eddington tensor in the optically thin regime. It really means collecting 1 over r squared contribution from all sources. So this is just like a gravity with a different potential. You know how to do it fast and efficiently. And the result of this is optically thin variable Eddington tensor approximation. So that's where this OTVET comes from. So this whole class of approximations in radiative transfer is normally code variable Eddington tensor. And optically seen, we use this Eddington tensor from the optically seen regime. So its scaling is very beneficial. It scales hydrodynamics with number of cells times the number of frequency bins, which is always there. And the Eddington tensor is like gravity. We can do it in n log n using a variety of different methods. It's very straightforward. So its advantage is that it's fast. It's actually, it's an approximation. It's not an exact solver, but it's controlled. You can actually test the error of this posteriori. It doesn't scale with the number of sources. It works for arbitrary source function. And the energy density in the flux are actually conserved exactly because we are solving first two moments exactly. So it fails in some particular cases, and this one of the probably the strongest, the most demonstrative example where it fails. If you have a strong source of radiation and a weak source of radiation, and they both create H2 regions around them, and a strong source creates a big one, and the weak source creates a small one. But let's imagine we're catching this at the moment when those two I fronts actually meet. Right? So those H2 regions are just touching each other. Because the Eddington tensor is calculated in the optically seen regime, that this weak source actually feels the strong source where it shouldn't. And so this is, produces a distortion on the shape of the I front around this weak source. But fortunately, God was very good to us. And the way the I front speed depends on the source strength and the distance, the way numbers come out, it turns out that this error is only significant in the ring of the width 1/6 of the size of the H2 region. So what it does, it makes this round H2 region a little bit X-shaped like. Right? So it distorts the shape, but it has the right number of ionizing photons in it, and it propagates with the right speed. So it fails. This is probably the worst case where it fails, or one of the worst cases. So it's an approximation, and so you can always choose to do the more costly but the exact way of doing things, or you actually had a choice. But now we might not actually have a choice, because what's happening right now in numerical cosmology is sort of a generation change. So the 20th century, last century, we used different kinds of numerical schemes to model, to run cosmological simulations, beginning from Eulerian schemes on uniform mesh, to smooth particle hydrodynamics, and then there are a couple of these arbitrary Lagrangian Eulerian codes. Those codes are really outdated now, right? So or at least they're becoming outdated now. So there is a general change to the next generation of computer codes based on adaptive mesh refinement. And it's not because I like one and I don't like the other one. There are actually physical reasons why this has happened. Right? This happens because adaptive mesh refinement allows you to do things which are not possible with old schemes. It allows you to follow fragmentation. And we're actually reaching scales where fragmentation becomes important. We're trying to resolve star formation on large scales. And fragmentation in the giant molecular clouds becomes important. It allows us to treat non-uniform initial conditions. And for a very large range of problems, it actually becomes crucial. And it allows us to control spatial resolution. And there are also advantages, especially in ionization simulations, for treating different regions with different resolutions. The problem is adaptive mesh refinement that you cannot do ray tracing on it. Right? So if you imagine a mesh which is highly refined in one region and less refined in some other region, and you put a source there, and depending which way your rays go, again, if you want to make your resolutions consistent, compatible with each other, you have to have many more rays to sample these structures than to sample those. And so essentially, you're reducing your highly adaptive mesh into uniform mesh. You need to have as many arrays as there are small cells in the simulation, and this is not possible. And the advantage of a PET approximation, PET basically doesn't care what mesh you use. You're using it like a hydrodynamics, and I'm just going to show you like an advertisement, a short commercial clip of ionization front propagating from the center of the galaxy through the IGM. This is actually the density inside. This is the density in this region. And what you're looking at is neutral fraction. Pink means neutral. It's 1. And green is about 10 to the minus 3 neutral fraction. And black 10 to the minus 6. So this red stuff is the ionization front. Right? And you see the region with the mesh, and this is refined mesh. It has a very complicated shape. It refined that wants it to refine. So you can just watch this thing. Yes? Well, you have different high resolution regions, right? And so I was too lazy to put two high resolution regions, but you want to have it from one to the other.
Well,
I mean, the point is that if you really want to make sure that your resolutions are consistent, that you're doing your gauge transfer with the same resolution as you're doing your gas dynamics, then it will be very difficult to do it in AMR. I mean, I may be not smart enough to figure out how the way of doing this, and so maybe someone smarter than me can actually figure it out. So I'm not saying it's not impossible. Okay. It's a little bit choppy because I didn't have springs. But I think what you should notice is that as the front propagates through those mesh interfaces, it gets spread because the resolution lowers, but there are basically no artifacts generated. There's no reflections of the mesh interfaces and things like that. And so, well, what do you mean was the exact solution? You don't know. You can only test the exact solution on some simple test, right? And so in this case, you can test this, right? There's no exact solution for this thing. Yeah. So if, as usual with all numerical schemes, you have to test them very well first, right? And I can tell you about all the tests that I have. So, but this is, again, it's not actually the main point. It's definitely not the ultimate answer, because you can try to compare the way we do the gauge transfer with the way we do the n-body. Again, n-body is also a six-dimensional Boltzmann equation. This problem is solved for all practical purposes. Okay? So if you compare different methods, ray tracing is analogous to direct summation in n-body. And direct summation is still used today for specific problems, but it's not suitable for large cosmological simulations. It's a threat approximation. It's something like using hydrodynamics to model the dark matter. Also, it's probably a little bit better than that. But ideologically, it's on this level. We are dealing with moment equations. But actually, in n-body, we are not using either of those. Right? They're all things of the past. Right? So today, if we need to do something quickly and dirty, we use what's called particle mesh, PM method. And for really big simulations, we use either PQPM 3 or adaptive mesh refinement. And we don't have any methods, I did transfer, which actually correspond to those two. So I think I finished the sort of general words, but the main thing that there's really a lot of work to do for young graduate students, and really we're very far behind in dealing with adjective transfer compared to what we can do with anybody. So there's really a large room for smart people come and invent smart methods and to do everything that we are doing right now 10 times, 100 times better. And so I'll finish on this optimistic note. So for you, Jan.
Okay, well, we're way ahead of schedule, so I'm not just kind of
Nick, there's one aspect of your beautiful algorithm that you didn't discuss, which was dropping the speed of light to accelerate the computation.
Well, that's a detail, right? So there are many technical details you have to go to make it work. Yes.
No, I'm fine with that. I was just wondering whether you could share a little bit of your experience on the side effects of doing that. I mean, first of all, how do you justify it? And second of all, where does it fail?
Well, it fails whenever. So the basic question is that I mentioned that photons move with speed of light, and so you have this ridiculously short time scale compared to all other physical time scales in the problem, like the light travel time across your box. Right? So because the speed of light is 30,000 times larger than the speed of sound. Whenever you treat a data transfer as a sort of kind of fluid, we cannot really follow 30,000 time steps to each hydrodynamic time step. So what we do, we reduce the speed of light. Because after all, we are solving this in Newtonian approximation. So we're really expanding the full deterministic equations in powers 1 over c and retaining the first terms. So we're solving everything which is 1 over c less than the leading term. And so all we care is that the speed of light is actually large enough compared to all characteristic speeds in the problem. And so if instead of 300,000 kilometers per second, it's 3,000 kilometers per second, it's still much faster than anything that moves around. There's the only limitation of this is that you may have a problem when your bifront should be moving with the speed of light. But if you reduce the speed of light, it would move actually less than that. And there is a just dirty numerical trick which can fix that. So we actually, our fronts, our information propagates with the speed of light. But it's just, you know, a small trick. So I don't know where it actually fails. The fact that the speed of light is less than 300,000 kilometers per second. The information still propagates with the speed of light in those simulations.
Nick, I have two small questions. The first one, where would you put Monte Carlo method in your
It's a way of ray tracing.
No, well, but it's different.
Well, I mean, it's a flavor of this. I mean, you can probably split, have 100 different flavors. I mean, you're just following individual photons, right? And you can either do it on a more or less regular way, like Tom was doing, or you can do it in a statistical sense, as you were doing.
Okay, the first one. The second one is that Monte Carlo makes very easy to treat things like, for example, diffuse radiation coming from recombinations. How well is Otbed doing in that sense?
Well, in this sense, it doesn't matter because it doesn't care about what your source is. You can have a source everywhere. You can have allow the whole density distribution emit photons. So it doesn't care about it. I mean, it's automatically included. Right? In a sense, it doesn't matter what your source function is. Right? It can be as individual sources as a bunch of delta functions, or it can be the whole density distribution, and you have recombination photons going as density squared or something. So it doesn't care about the source function. So it's one of the advantages. Again, I'm not saying that this is the ultimate solution. I'm saying that the ultimate solution actually doesn't exist yet. So you have to wait for someone young and smart to come, or maybe old and smart, I don't know. I actually spend enough time thinking about this and inventing a good approach to doing this. It can be done because we have an example of six-dimensional problem which is solved. All practical purposes.
Nick, you might have overrated the speed of light, because in some cases, at least, what you need to follow is the speed, how fast the ionization front is traveling, not the speed of light. So so you could have thought of clever schemes which you don't have to follow the speed of light, rather just follow the speed of the ionization front.
I'm not sure I'm following you. I said the information is propagated with the speed of light. You can use numerical trick to make sure it actually.
That's what I'm saying.
Speed propagation is right, but that's a technical detail.
Well, I mean, it's a technical detail by a factor of 100. So.
What I'm saying it is the speed of light.
Let me just make a comment on that one as well. When Nick and I wrote the paper, we made that one big mistake that we called it the reduced speed of light approximation. I think in reality what we do is we drive it at supercourant times. So it turns out that the method actually is stable, and we can take larger timescales than you anticipate from the signal speed. And so, I mean, if we would have just called it different, you'd realize we propagate things at the right speed and get the correct solution.
Well, it's always a solution to invent a very complicated name which no one understands and call it a supercurrent condition scheme, and then of course no one would object to it. And if you try to invent something simple like reduced speed of light, then of course there'll be many objections for why speed of light is reduced. Yeah, it's always a solution.
Exactly. But just one other point with ray tracing. of course, there's ways to do adaptive ray tracing. I implemented an adaptive ray tracing scheme in an AMR code, and it's it does work. And so we have at least one method to try to do the transfer exact.
Well, now, I would like to see how you would do that, right? So, because I thought about it, and so again, maybe I'm not smart enough, and you're smart enough. I know how your adaptive scheme works, right? But you're only saving a given factor compared to the, you're not beating down the scaling. The scaling stays the same. It's a coefficient in front of the scaling which changes.
Yeah, Nick, I'm not arguing with that. It's never going to be good for 100,000 of sources. But the good thing is we have an exact method that we can try any of the other approximations.
Oh, so we have one source, then there's no problem. What do you do if you have 300 million stars in your simulation? What do you do with them?
The basis for your the angular distribution of your radiation field in the optically thin approximation, where you take the luminosity from each source and you reduce it by 1/r², would seem to be a bad approximation when strong shadowing effects are important. And the radiation field becomes highly anisotropic, and you're not simply sensitive to the nearest source on the ionized transparent side of a surface.
Well, as I tried to say, so apparently failed, that the flux is actually conserved exactly. We're not picking a field as optically thin. It's only the Eddington tensor, which is calculated as optically thin approximation. And it's actually for the shadowing, for a single source, it's exact. This approximation is exact for a single source, but it's not exact for when your number of sources is greater than one, but not very large. It again becomes exact in the limit when the number of sources is very large. So it's actually exact in the optically thin limit as well. So it's only non-exact in this intermediate regime when you have several sources.
So how does it fail? To what extent does it fail to reproduce sharp shadows? Have you done any tests of
that? Yes, we did tests on shadowing, and it actually, again, it depends how specifically you set it. So for a single source in the infinite field, it's actually exact. In reality, we're running simulations with periodic boundary conditions, and this actually produces some artifacts. So in this case, there is a front which propagates behind the shadow at about 1/10 of the speed of I front. In reality, it doesn't actually matter because shadowing is never important in cosmological simulations. If you compare timescales, recombination timescale is 100 times longer than the dynamical timescale. So those shadows exist for a tiny period of time compared to...
Well, there certainly is a shadow on the neutral side of an ionization front. So I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, the neutral gas is shielded from this...
It's not a shadow. The shadow is something neutral blocks the source. We probably have a different definition of shadow then.
Right.
I said the I front speed is actually correct because the flux is conserved and the photon number is conserved. Exactly.
Nick, I had a question about background radiation.
Yes.
I mean, there's some circumstances where you could be at a location where the background would dominate the local sources. And I'm just wondering, how do you do that? Is that you take the background as God-given, Madow-given or something? Or is it just, can you do it self-consistently?
You can do it both, right? So depending of...
Well, I'm just curious, how do you do it? How would you do it self-consistently when you just have a finite...
Well, you have periodic boundary conditions, so the whole universe is filled with those periodic boxes, and those boxes...
So you just generate boxes all over the place?
Yeah, and those boxes generate your background, okay. But you can also put the background by hand.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's... This is already a detail of what you're actually going to do. It's not a part of a scheme.
I think it's an important question because in some schemes for ionizing quasar absorption systems, that's not been done self-consistently yet. That's why I'm asking you that question.
Well, you can do this self-consistently, yes. I mean, the whole purpose of this is to make sure it can be done self-consistently. But they can also do it non-self-consistently if you wish. So. obviously. It's kind of a trivial statement, which probably everyone would agree. Yeah.
There was some discussion earlier about the scatter at the time due to cosmic variance, at the time at which different regions arrive at full ionization, and I wanted to ask you about what you think the limitations in terms of the box size at the moment are, because you argued for a while that the scatter is rather small according to the simulations you have done of realization. Could you comment about the question of what do you think the actual scatter is at the time at which...
I think there's a difference between the error and the mean error. Right? So I think the whole confusion came from this. So if you take individual lines of sight, the scatter would be rather large, yes.
So how much would you expect for the quasars that we heard about? What would you expect the scatter in the transmission redshift?
The scatter in the transmitter?
At redshift at which the IGM becomes transparent to Lyman alpha photons.
I don't remember the number of my height, but
it's in
the
order of 0.1 or for the
redshift. No, it's probably less than 1, but probably more than 0.1. Right, so whenever I talked about the redshift of ionization, I'm talking about the error of the mean, and this can be done more precisely than the mean error. Right? And so that's, I think, that's different. So individual scatter is larger, but when we're talking about the average, we can measure the average more precisely than the scatter of individual lines of sight because we average.
And you don't think it's limited currently by the simulation? How big was the Earth, your biggest simulation box, and do you think it's a limitation?
But the box is always a limitation until you can go to the horizon size.
But did you reach the point where you think they were confident?
It's actually a difficult question to answer. I will know the answer to this in about a year. Right. So right now, my biggest box was 8 megaparsecs, and I ran 4, and I know that when I calculate the mean transmission as a function of redshift, then they're basically indistinguishable. Right. Whether it's a real convergence or for some reason some kind of artifact of the fact that just happened that in those two scales things behave similarly, I don't know, but we'll have much bigger boxes and actually we'll have ways of taking cosmic variance in a much smarter way, adaptive mesh refinement. That opens the AMR opens just basically, you know, the whole new sea of opportunities. And we're running simulations on underlying simulations right now, which actually has a big box and several small boxes in certain of this at different regions, like with the mean density, plus one sigma fluctuation, minus one sigma fluctuation. And we're doing everything self-consistently, and so we can actually look at the cosmic effects of cosmic variance on individual scales. So
what's the variance of the box times the bias? You could just what's the variance of the box times the bias?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't actually, because the density changes as well, and so the regions which have more sources also have high density in general, and you only care about the number of ionizing photons per baryon, and so in the linear regime it's actually canceled out exactly, and so the bias also doesn't actually matter in the linear regime. So if you are not fully in the linear regime, then you have non-linear corrections which cause you. Well, recombination rate for the ionization is not very important because most of the IGM doesn't recombine. You know, it's density is way too low. Oh, in the linear regime, they're linearly biased. So in the linear regime, it's actually cancelled out. The number of ionizing photons doesn't depend on density. But if you go to nonlinear tails, then things become complicated. Can you use the mic because I don't hear you. Well, we're talking about most of the volume, what you see in the quasar spectra. Of course, there are always details. Most of the volume never recombines. Most of the volume sits in voids with cosmic density 0.1. Those regions have recombination time equal Hubble time at redshift 15 or something. And so they never recombine since redshift 15.
All right. So. You'll like what I'm going to say. I actually agree that what you're doing is very important, the radiative transfer problem, because we're moving into the time where we want precise matches between simulations and data. And a lot of these effects, I think, are going to start to show up in disagreements between simulations. Well, simulations that do not have radiative transfer will differ from data, and some of the reasons will be because they don't have radiative transfer. So I want to pursue that idea. in two directions. That one way in which radiative transfer is different from an optically thin simulation is that it places ionized at different times, right? And that's the issue you've been discussing with Avi and so on. And the second way is that different places will experience different spectra, right? Because the photons get absorbed, and that's why you're carrying the frequency term in there. I wondered if you could discuss the relative importance of those two, because given you can't solve the whole problem, you could, for instance, throw away frequency, right? And you could just...
Well, you don't want to throw away the frequency dependence.
No, but can you compare the two? Which is more important in terms of getting a better match to data? Time of ionization, frequency, no?
If you throw away, what would happen if I throw away the frequency dependence?
Mm-hmm.
I can give you a guess. I mean, but it's just a guess. So for hydrogen ionization, what probably matters is the number of ionizing photons. For the helium ionization state, then the spectrum probably matters a great deal. And that would be the short answer.
I mean, for instance, if you want to match line widths in Lyman alpha forest, it matters you get the ionization time right, and in particular the photon energy right. Right? If the X-rays are doing some of the ionizing, the gas will be hotter and so on. Those sort of issues. And that'll show up in data. And I would imagine already shows up.
I'm not sure what I should like an answer to this. Yeah, it will show up in data at some point. Well, we can just try different spectrum.
It's very optimistic about the amount of information
if you heat the given region to a higher temperature, it may talk for quite a while. And you can see that there will be wider lines, well, less narrow lines.
There would be fluctuations in the
Nick, I noticed in your little movie that you are actually don't seem to be resolving, to be refining on the ionization fraction on the AMR
method. Yeah, in this particular one, the ionization front is not refined.
So do you think it will matter, because I have done before ionization front tracking on adaptive grid, and it actually needs to refine it to resolve it and track it properly?
Well, I didn't find that, so. I ran several tests and it works very well. It goes across mesh interfaces without feeding them at all. And it agrees with, again, for simple tests, like a single I-front in a homogeneous medium, I send it through very complicated meshes and it just doesn't feed them. So I'm not sure what will.
Well, your method is conservative, so you're guaranteed to get the right I-front.
Yes. The average I-front spin is guaranteed to be right because it's conservative. I mean, it's one of the advantages of using this thing on the adaptive mesh refinement mesh, because it's like a gas dynamics, it's a conservative scheme. Okay.
You won't get the width.
No. Width is resolution dependent, yes. And so if you want to get the width right, then, yeah. But okay. All you care is how fast it moves, really. I mean, you don't care about the detail of this I-front at 0.1 cosmic density at redshift 7 because, or 8, no one would ever observe this. And so why would you care about that?
Okay.
Well, the eye front will overrun you very fast.
Okay, this discussion session is quite long, so I don't know if we're going to start
asking about how many lines you have in this part of the code, then I think
it's time to stop.